And I've produced two publications for them, which they've asked me to draw to your attention. They're both free as downloads. One looking at cross-media regulation, which was out last year, and one looking at international press councils and comparing different press councils, which was published at the end of April. So, as I say, they're both available as free downloads from the Reuters Institute websites, and I'll draw on both reports talking to you today. So what I'd like to do, really, is ask three key questions. Is the public well served by current media standards regulation in the UK? What are the lessons from overseas? And thirdly, what might a future settlement for standards in content across media platforms look like? So first up, I'd like to address consumer and citizen interests. On the one hand, as technologies advance apace, media content and delivery are characterised by mutation and convergence. Newspapers are, as we know, not just printed, but online and carry video packages with the look and feel of traditional television. Broadcasters publish websites, including text-based articles, similar to online print offerings. Scheduled programmes are broadcast, but they're also available on demand, on digital channels, and a variety of websites. User-generated material vies for online audiences alongside commercially produced content. Professional and amateur bloggers share the same debates. But on the other hand, the standards regulating media content are essentially static and divided. Broadcast content is subject to comprehensive rules set down by Parliament. Video-on-demand content attracts lighter-touch co-regulation with just two editorial rules, one on incitement, one on hardcore porn. The press, at least for the present, is governed by voluntary self-regulated rules, and wider online content may be subject to no regulatory authority beyond the courts. But accessed via a PC, a smartphone, a tablet device, highly regulated, lightly regulated, unregulated content, licensed and unlicensed services are becoming impossible to differentiate. With the advent of internet-connected televisions, they sit side by side on the living room TV, fueling the potential for consumer confusion over whether the content with which they engage is regulated, and if so, to what extent and by whom. So it was that the House of Lords Select Committee on Communications last year found itself baffled by the complexity of regulatory processes. And it's worth reading their report for the table they drew up, illustrating the often overlapping, sometimes competing jurisdictions, complaint handling and differing requirements of the BBC Trust, of Ofcom, of the Authority for Video on Demand, the PCC, of PhonePe Plus, of TMAP in relation to teenagers, as well as individual providers. Take impartiality, which has been at the core of broadcasting requirements, in part associated with the power of a medium traditionally seen as an uninvited guest in the living room, and underpinned by the leverage of license agreements allowing broadcasters access to spectrum. By contrast, partiality lies at the heart of newspaper freedom and has traditionally been associated with active consumer choice. But as the two media converge, the distinction between the rules governing each begins to appear arbitrary and opaque. I expect ITN coverage to be impartial, but what should I expect of ITN material embedded in a Daily Mail offering which I access on demand? What should my expectations be of the British National Party's BNP TV, which brands itself as an online television channel? Which rules are in play? What am I to make as a consumer of Ofcom's recent decision to revoke the licence of Iranian-funded Press TV and thus ban it from broadcasting when I can continue to access it online? How meaningful is the goal of the current Communications Act, which sets out protection to members of the public as a duty for linear broadcasting, and which Ofcom translates into a code of 173 comprehensive rules, including harm, offence, crime, religion, due impartiality, due accuracy, rules on undue prominence of views and opinions, elections, referendums, fairness, privacy. When online, I'm pretty much left to get on with it. And for younger consumers, this is an increasingly significant issue. Ofcom's 2010 look at Consumers' Digital Day showed that while for the over 55s, two-thirds of media and communications activity was carried out through a television set, for the 16 to 24s, it was only 30%. They relied on their computers, mobile phones, tablet devices. And while we might console ourselves that linear TV viewing, with all its accompanying protections, is still very popular, in the 2010 research it accounted for 90% of video viewing among the over 55s, but for the 16 to 24s, 26% of their viewing was non-linear and not subject to these protections. Added to this, younger converged consumers do not have the same reference points, such as brand associations, that to some extent may exist older consumers in forming expectations around different content. It's my belief that the current debate over the future of press regulation, which will be addressed by the outcome of the Leveson inquiry, cannot be isolated from wider considerations of reform of media regulation, if regulatory coherence is to be achieved. This poses a considerable challenge, but with it comes a significant opportunity for reformed press regulation to provide the foundations for a new regulatory settlement flexible enough to support existing and emerging media consumers and providers across platforms. So, turning to my second question, what can we learn from press and media councils overseas? The lesson that rapidly emerges from an exploration of press regulation across the globe is that it provides not so much a window on a foreign world as a mirror in which an array of common problems are reflected back at us. The reality is that press councils around the world are grappling with profound challenges: the role and status of new media, converging content across print, broadcasting and online platforms, and financial austerity are just some of these testing issues. There is no one solution, no blueprint for reform, but there are interesting and valuable perspectives. The issue right at the heart of debate over press regulation in the UK is between voluntary and mandatory requirements. But look overseas and you find not a binary choice, but a spectrum of approaches. They range from the wholly voluntary self or peer regulation of industry by industry, as in Germany, through independent regulation where representatives of the public or, as in the case of Sweden, the judiciary, provide a significant presence on press councils. There's incentivised regulation where voluntary press council membership is recognised in statute, as in Ireland, and co-regulation, which includes elements of statutory compulsion, as in Denmark, and there are many shades of regulation between and beyond. Voluntary regulation carries with it the threat, as we know, of publishers pulling publications out of the regulatory body, notoriously illustrated by Richard Desmond's decision to withdraw his titles from the PCC. Canada is instructive in this regard. In July 2011, its largest newspaper publisher, Sun Media Corporation, pulled all its publications, 27 out of the 37 daily newspapers in Ontario, out of the Ontario Press Council, accusing it of a politically correct mentality that was incompatible with its urban tabloids. In Quebec, 40% of news publications sit outside the regulatory framework, and this January the Manitoba Press Council shut down after the last participating newspapers withdrew. Canada offers a stark lesson in what happens when newspapers feel they have no stake in a voluntary system and suffer no consequences from withdrawal. At the other end of the regulatory spectrum, Denmark provides the example of a co-regulatory combination of mandatory requirements and self-regulatory elements, backed by the sanction of a fine or imprisonment if a publisher or broadcaster fails to publish a decision. However, even in such a context, compliance remains an issue. This February, the Danish Parliamentary Committee on Legal Affairs and Culture issued a statement citing recent egregious errors in the Danish press and failures in relation to prominent publication of Press Council adjudications. The committee has embarked on a scrutiny of the Press Council, its powers and its future, and will report later this year. And if you want a really radical approach to future regulation, there's Australia, where the government commissioned a wide-ranging convergence review to assess the effectiveness of current media regulation and make recommendations for its future in a convergent era. The review reported at the end of last month, following a wide consultation with community, industry and other interest groups. It sets out a vision of regulating according to the size and scope of media enterprises, rather than how they deliver their content. It recommends an industry-led cross-platform news standards body, membership of which would be mandatory for the largest providers, those with the most significant revenues and impact on Australians. Probably around 15 media operators would be caught by the compulsory requirements, while other providers would be encouraged to join. But while the proposals are deregulatory in relation to Australian broadcasting, they impose new mandatory regulation on some press and online services, ultimately backed by referral to a new statutory regulator, and that's why they've resulted in a stormy debate about freedom of speech. The Australian government will deliver its verdict on the proposals next month, but at the very least, they call time on easy assumptions about regulating according to an accident of delivery platform. Perhaps the most significant area is the middle ground between voluntary and mandatory regulation, where the starting point is compliance rather than sanctions. Here, Ireland offers a useful example of a regulatory framework in which incentivised active compliance is voluntary but recognised in statute and independent both of industry and the state. Essentially, an incentivised approach identifies the privileges and rights accorded to journalists and then recognises adherence to regulation as an ethical, accountable demonstration that the publication merits those privileges. In Ireland, this recognition applies in defamation proceedings, where a court can take into account Press Council membership and adherence to the Press Council's code and determinations when considering whether publication of a statement was defamatory or fair and reasonable. Interestingly, the Irish Daily Star, co-owned by Richard Desmond, is, like the majority of the Irish press, a Press Council member. In New Zealand, the Law Commission has taken this a step further and is considering whether adherence to ethical standards and accountability might be linked more widely to a range of protections and rights for journalists, not just defamation defences, but exemptions from data protection restrictions, as we've talked about, rights of attendance in certain court and parliamentary sessions, and protection of sources. And so for my third question, what might a future settlement for coherent standards across media platforms look like in the UK? I would invite you to picture the current framework with vertical divisions between the requirements placed on broadcasting, on print, on video on demand, and on digital media. Now, picture a future framework with horizontal tiers cutting across platforms. In the top tier is public service content, however it's delivered, which under this proposal would be subject to comprehensive statutory requirements, a gold standard, if you like, required of the BBC, Channel 4, S4C, and currently ITV and Channel 5, whose portfolio of channels between them accounted in the 2010 research for over 70% of all viewer hours in multi-channel homes. Comprehensive rules, potentially not dissimilar to the current Ofcom code, would apply across all public service platforms, including related websites and video on demand provision. Impartiality requirements would provide access to balanced coverage and a range of viewpoints of particular public significance and debate. Commercial public service providers would be incentivised to continue to maintain their commitment to public service provision through such benefits as electronic programme guide prominence and enhanced access to audiences and advertising via the public service multiplexes. Standards requirements would be part of the expectations placed on them, but also a transparent demonstration of excellence and authority, differentiating their offerings from the rest of industry. The second tier would introduce a new model of independent voluntary regulation, recognised in statute initially for the press and, as it develops, open to non-public service media across print, broadcasting, video on demand and wider online provision. The press would embrace the freedoms and privileges on which its journalism is founded, but would also have a voluntary but clear mechanism for acknowledging the duties and responsibilities that accompany them. Newspapers in print and online, and wider journalists and bloggers, would have the choice of electing standards as a commercial and ethical selling point through this model of regulation and enjoying associated benefits, which could include an attractive way of demonstrating accountability and ethics in defamation and privacy proceedings and in relation to journalists' rights to protection of sources, data protection exemptions, and perhaps in relation to cross-media ownership. Conversely, providers could choose to operate outside the regulated sphere and simply within the law, as is the case for unregulated online content. But if faced with the task of satisfying the courts, the public, their own employees and others that they offer ethical accountability, they would have to do so outside of the regulatory framework. For members, the most significant sanction for compliance failures would be suspension or expulsion from the regulatory fold and therefore from associated benefits. And a third tier would provide a baseline of regulation. Requirements could include protection of the under-18s from extreme content, prohibition on incitement to hatred, and commercial obligations. These are requirements that are currently compulsory under the European Directive in relation to broadcast and video-on-demand services. Put most simply, the top tier would, among other commitments, offer impartiality, the second tier, accuracy, the third tier, basic safeguards. Crucial to this proposal is transparency for the consumer. Each tier would be required to be signalled as a readily recognisable standards mark, displayed on electronic programme guides, in print, and clearly flagged on websites or other electronic media. In this way, consumers, and indeed advertisers, would be enabled to make informed decisions about the content with which they engage. And each tier would be open on an opt-in basis so that providers could make choices about where to position their content. So to conclude, the ambition would be to move towards a coherent settlement that provides for a range of content across the public space, incentivises transparently signalled standards as an ethical, legal and commercial selling point for both existing and emerging media providers, and places informed, enabled citizens at its heart. Thank you.